Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Dr. Benedetta Legranzi. I lead the WHO Clean Care is Safer Care program within WHO Patient Safety Department. I'm very happy today to chair this other free teleclass hosted by Weber Training. And I'm very happy to introduce Professor Goldman, who is clearly very well known and is part of our steering committee. In addition to this, you will know that Professor Dawn Goldman is Senior Advice President of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, IHI, where he's responsible for fellowship training, faculty relations, innovation, publications, knowledge management. He's also infectious diseases clinical staff at Children's Hospital in Boston and professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, professor of immunology and infectious diseases at the Harvard School of Public Health. We all know him for his research in infection control in particular, but also in health services and vaccine development over the last 3 decades at least. And of course, he has many other duties and roles in advisory boards and important international and national organizations. So therefore, I really thank him for devoting his time to this presentation today. The presentation's title is Successes and Challenges in Developing and Implementing Bundles in Infection Prevention. And I'm sure he will really tell us his experience from the knowledge gathered through the IHI work over the last year exactly on this topic. I would like to also remind the audience that unfortunately today won't be possible to make questions, but you are invited to send any questions through emails to the Weber system. So thank you very much again, Dawn, and I let you start now.
Okay, well, hello everybody. I guess it depends where you are, whether it's morning, afternoon, or evening, but I hope you're having a good day. This is always, at least in Boston, a somewhat sad time of the year because the summer is technically over because we end our summer on Labor Day, and the days are suddenly growing shorter. The traffic in the streets is much worse because school has started, and it's raining. So despite all of that, I'm going to be very upbeat and enthusiastic and dispel the demons of the shortening days and the coming of fall and winter. So you see my title slide there, and we'll move right on to the first slide with content. And what I'm going to talk about here are various methods that we commonly use in healthcare to bring evidence and reliability to our everyday practice. And, of course, one of the most common things we use is clinical practice guideline, and I'm sure you all have many examples of this in your possession. And I've been on committees that have written these guidelines, and usually they take many months of hard work and long literature searches. And there's some problems with these guidelines, at least in my experience. They tend to be long and tedious. There isn't that much guidance regarding the relative importance of each of the elements of the guidelines or what to do when, as is often the case, in fact, more often than not, the evidence is weak. How do you learn from these application of these guidelines, especially where the evidence is weak? How do you sequence your work? How do you actually implement the guidelines? How do you measure their impact? All these things are not generally spelled out or not spelled out well in clinical practice guidelines I've seen. And, of course, they're not really written with decision support at the point of care in mind. you don't carry around a 50-page guideline with 600 references to the bedside and say, okay, here on page 34 it said I should give such and such drug. And in fact, I think it's interesting that we often even forget we have these guidelines. I was at a meeting some years ago where we were discussing a responsible use of antibiotics, and the Infectious Disease Society of America had written a very comprehensive guideline. And at the start of that multidisciplinary meeting, I asked people who knew where their copy of the guideline was. This was, of course, before the Internet was popular. And only a very small minority of people even knew where they put it, let alone were using it. So I got this impression that guidelines sit on the shelf. And even in the Internet age, I think it's very unusual for somebody to read through an entire guideline to keep it fresh in their mind and relevant to their practice. Next slide. So another way to enhance the reliability of care and bring evidence to the bedside is what is called a clinical pathway. Some of you may call this a care pathway, it's the same thing. In general, a pathway will specify a relatively homogeneous subset of patients to whom it applies. There'll be clear boundaries in time. When do you start and stop the guideline, to whom and where does it apply? There will be an evidence review that hopefully makes the pathway reflect the evidence. Sometimes you have to use expert consensus or Delphi techniques to arrive at what you're going to put in the clinical pathway. And, of course, you should specify where evidence is solid and when it's not. And usually there's a formal evidence grading system, as there would be in a clinical practice guideline as well. Also, in these pathways, you usually have a process flow diagram, which preferably leads to clear, measurable outcomes. There's a measurement framework for each clinical process and the outcome. And the pathway will make it clear who does what, where, and when. And if it'd be helpful, and some pathways have this, a little bit about the how you actually do it and why you're doing it. So, in essence, it's a streamlined, pared-down version of a clinical practice guideline that is meant to guide the way in which care is provided at the bedside. There are other approaches to this. I'm going to talk about these now for a bit. Again, the goal here is to get reliability, and rather than using guidelines and care pathways, sometimes people will use what we call bundles, and I'll be spending some time on bundles, and checklists, which are often associated with checklists, and then some tools for actually developing the process of care so it is more reliable and error-free. And finally, I'll touch on lean consumption and tell you what that is. So first, a little bit about reliability, and we tend to throw that term around, but there is a science behind reliability, and what reliability science would tell us is that healthcare is riddled with what these scientists call defects. We may have other words for them, errors or whatever, but in reliability, we think of them as defects in the process of care. And as you know, there are lots of problems, and still, even with all of the work that WHO has done and we've done here in the United States, I'm sure in your countries, compliance with hand hygiene still is, in some cases, only 40 or 50%. And that, of course, is astonishing, which is why I have on this slide a couple of exclamation points and question marks. And I studied this some time ago to see what other industries did, and Intel, as you know, makes the world's leading supplier of computer chips, and these chips are produced in so-called clean rooms, and it's well known that if there are any mishaps in terms of contamination or dust or whatever, you can easily ruin an entire rack of these chips. And so at Intel, in order to get into that room, you've got to not just wash your hands, but you kind of grease up your body a little bit, and you put on a total body suit, and you wear uncomfortable overgarments while you're working. And all of this is monitored by cameras. And if you deviate from that protocol, you get a warning. If you deviate more than once, you may just be given your pink slip, or you may be asked to resign. So some of us think that it's time for accountability around issues like hand hygiene, where even in the most resource-constrained settings, you can have alcohol hand rub. You can just show where personnel are best going to find that hand rub when they need it. Now you can do the training. You can do all kinds of stuff to make it the environment so conducive to hand hygiene. Anybody doesn't perform it is actually now not just making a mistake or having an error, but they've actually, it's kind of a violation. And there should be accountability for that, and I believe that pretty strongly. At some point, you got to get there. Remember that in reliability, from the patient's point of view, it doesn't matter that you did part of it right. It's all or nothing. You either came in the room in which they're on isolation precautions and did all the components correctly, or you didn't. And if you didn't do them all, then from the point of view of the patient, you failed. And reliability science does offer some pretty good approaches to reducing these defects and their associated harm. So next slide. Here you see the difference between component and composite adherence to contact precautions. This is just data that I kind of abstracted from a large study and summarized. But you can see that if you look at each component of what you're supposed to do when a patient's on contact precautions, if you're just looking at hand hygiene and we're putting on gloves when entering the room, the hospital may be 80% compliant. If you look on whether they wore a gown, it may be 78%. If you ask whether they washed their hands after they left the room and removed their gloves, they might be at 65%. But to get all three of them right, it's more like 40 or 50%. So from an all-or-nothing point of view, the defect rate here is 50% or more. Next slide. Reliability, then, is failure-free operation over time from the point of view of the patient. And next slide, you can see this schematically for heart failure. There's a long period of time prior to hospitalization where the primary care system may not be noticing and treating and caring for heart failure appropriately. There are defects in care there. That can lead to a needless hospitalization that could have been avoided by good outpatient care. But then there are defects in the hospital itself. Maybe the right drug wasn't prescribed, the right test of cardiac function wasn't done. And then, of course, you have to discharge the patient, and that handover can be riddled with defects. And then once the patient's home, unless there's a really good system to pick up that patient and ensure reliable, error-free care, they're going to be back in hospital. So that's just a practical example, heart failure being one of the leading causes of hospital readmissions and admissions in the United States. Next slide shows levels of reliability, and I'm not going to dwell on this. Just notice in green there that what reliability science says is that if you're having failures or defects in greater than 20% of the opportunities, they call that chaos. And so we are living in chaos for almost all aspects of healthcare. The only really high reliability segments of healthcare are blood banking and anesthesiology, where they actually are quite reliable and get up to this kind of 10 to the fourth the level of reliability. Next slide. So just to summarize, reliability in healthcare, it's all or nothing, not compliance with each component of best practice. Most institutions do fairly well with individual components of evidence-based care, but performance drops a lot when you take it as an all or nothing standard. And it would be a modest proposal to decrease that defect rate, at least to get down to 10 to the minus 2 for common practices, and hopefully better than that. Next slide. So now let's go on to bundles, or as I sometimes call them, intervention packages, and you'll see why. And the question here is, in trying to get reliable care, what if just a few key actionable interventions, supported hopefully by strong evidence, were culled from those clinical practice guidelines and incorporated into care pathways at key action moments? So taking these bundled evidence-based components of care and inserting them right into the care process where they belong, where they need to be done to avoid harm. Next. So what is a bundle? A bundle is a grouping of best practices with respect to disease process. And the theory here is that if you do them all, you do better than just adding up the sum of doing each of them individually. Hopefully, and this is what often is stated in definitions of bundle, the science behind the bundle is so well established, it should be considered standard of care. But we all know better than this, and if you look at any bundle, like the ventilator and pneumonia bundle or the central line bundle, some of the ones I'll show you, there are clearly elements there that are controversial and not necessarily based on gold standard science. The bundle elements are dichotomous, and you can measure, did they do it, yes or no. Again, it's all or nothing. And in general, these elements in the bundle should be occurring at a specific single point in time. And so reflect about that a minute. If you're going to have a bundle, and especially if you're going to have a checklist, it's much easier if it's all occurring at a moment in time or in a close segment of time, as opposed to being strung over a long period of time where you got to fill out the checklist as you go and remember the elements of the bundle. And we'll come back to that. So now the next slide, we look at the central venous catheter bundle. And here, first you have the insertion bundle, which is very amenable to a checklist because it does occur at a moment in time. And it captures performance data and reinforces social norms. The bundle and its checklist essentially are the mechanism for capturing data about what's been done correctly or incorrectly. And you know the components. I'm not going to go over them now. Then there's the maintenance bundle, often forgotten, and people talk about central catheter bundles. And note that the elements for maintenance bundle are spread out over time, which complicates observations and makes it harder to have a checklist and document adherence. These elements as well, alcohol, hub prep, and other measures, timely removal of the catheter, and so forth. Next slide. We have antibiotic stewardship, and there have been efforts, and you'll read about bundles, to improve the appropriate utilization of antibiotics. And this is a real challenge for bundles because the interventions occur over quite a period of time. First, you have to choose the antibiotic, then you have to adjust the dose, then at some point, about 48 or 72 hours later, you have to make a decision as to de-escalating them. Then you may want to be switching from IV to oral therapy with an equivalent agent, and then you have to stop the therapy. And all that's strung out over what might be 10 days or 2 weeks. So would it be better to think about a care pathway with standardized order sets or checklists of a sort and real-time visible reminders along the care pathway at which you have decision support and a way to monitor whether or not adherence is done? So think about that. That's why I told you about the care pathway, because I think that bundles and checklists, if used best, are incorporated in a care pathway at just the right moment. Next slide. It's important, however, to remember that even if you have great bundles and you have reliable execution of bundles and care pathways, it's more than just bundles, checklists, and pathways. Has been explained by Mary Dixon Woods in the article I've quoted here in looking at the famous Keystone Project in Michigan that drove down catheter-related line infection rates very dramatically. Culture, peer norms, teamwork, communication, clarity of purpose, leadership alignment, and so forth were at least as critical as the evidence-based bundles. So now we're going to talk about ways to ensure reliability of systems or to study these systems design out anticipated problems. And this failure mode and effects analysis comes out of engineering and industry, but it's quite applicable to healthcare. You've probably all heard of it and maybe even doing it, but I'm going to go over it. It's such a fundamental tool. Next slide shows what an FMEA is. It identifies risk points. So remember, we have that care pathway. We have the process all lined up in a diagram. And there are specific places in that system that we will be able to surmise are susceptible to error or system breakdown. This may be from experience, or we may just be intuitively sure that that's an error-prone system where mistakes are going to happen. And, of course, these kinds of errors can occur from flaws in the design of the system. That's really common. Arise because there's a lot of dependence on communication among people and getting components of the system to talk to each other. There may be non-standard processes or systems where there's so much variation that nobody really can articulate what it is they're supposed to do. And then there may be a failure, absence of backup or duplication or redundancy in the system that allows you to buffer or mitigate errors when they do occur, because basically if the initial valve that's controlling the nuclear escape of radiation from the nuclear plant fails, you hopefully have a backup. And these backups better be robust, as we learned in the Japanese experience, where there were backups, but they all failed. So every system ought to have thoughtful redundancies and backups. Next slide shows the steps in doing an FMEA. You do your process flow diagram, which we've talked about. You go over that diagram assuming the absolute worst. I mean, you have to sit there and say, what might go wrong? And if you're sitting in Fukushima, you're going to say, well, one thing that might go wrong, an earthquake and a tidal wave, which is something they never thought about. In a smaller scale, that's how you need to be thinking. And by the way, as an aside, in any quality improvement project, I know we're always thinking it's minimal risk to patients. We're trying to get closer to ideal care. But even the most well-designed quality improvement process system may have unintended consequences, and it's important to think them through. And then determine what effects the failure might have on the rest of the process and ultimately on the patient. Next slide. Then you want to rank the estimated probability of bad stuff happening. And the details aren't important here, but basically you're looking at the severity of the failure, how harmful will it be, how likely is failure going to occur, just kind of your estimate of that. And then also your probability that it will be detected before the accident takes place. So it's a question of, will it be common, how severe will it be, and are we going to be able to detect and intercept it? And you just basically add all that up, and you get a criticality index that tells you how worried you ought to be about that particular point in the system. Remember, this is about each point in the system, not about the system as a whole. Next slide shows that you then figure out, well, how am I going to tweak the system, revise the system to lower the criticality index at these failure-prone points in the system and take action and then to improve the system, and then you monitor those error-prone points in the system over time to make sure you're absolutely reliable at executing at those deadly points. So I hope that's clear. It actually sounds really simple. It's really, really hard, and it's the kind of thing that you have to go through with an interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary team and get everybody's point of view about what kind of bad stuff could happen all along that system. Next slide shows you an analogous way of approaching this. I actually like this paradigm quite a bit. It's called hazard analysis and critical control point. And it's got a great name. I mean, it is about hazards, and it is about those critical points that control the outcome of the system, be it a patient or the production of ice cream. So it's a system that identifies and monitors specific foodborne hazards. This is where this came from. It came from the food industry that can adversely affect the safety of a food product. Pillsbury, the big food company, pioneered that along with National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, the U.S. Army, and the U.S. Air Force. What their goal was in the early 1960s, when the United States was really I would say at an apogee of its ambition and forward-thinking energy, trying to send astronauts into space, we want to make sure that they didn't have diarrhea in their spacesuits, especially in a no-gravity situation. So that was the point of HACCP, is to make 100% safe food for astronauts, and that's now been applied to the entire food industry. Next slide. And it's also the basis of good manufacturing process for the production of safe, pure, and effective drugs. It's all part of blood banking safety, and all this uses the critical control point schema. I'll tell you, if you go wrong in this kind of process, results can be disastrous. There's a well-known outbreak attributed to an ice cream company in the United States called Schwann. It's in the Midwest United States, family-owned business, highly loved for all of its fine ice cream product and flavors. They had a system for safely making ice cream, and part of the process is to put the components, the cream especially, into a truck, a tanker truck, and to take it to the factory where it was turned into ice cream Then it was sent in the truck for additional processing. And unfortunately, you're not supposed to use the same truck you use for carrying the unpasteurized egg product as carrying finished product, because eggs can carry salmonella. And there was an outbreak of salmonellosis written up in the New England Journal of Medicine that was estimated to have caused over 200,000 cases of salmonella in the United States. So bad slip-up at a critical control point in that manufacturing process. And I dare say that a slip-up in a critical control point in an intensive care unit or in a neonatal intensive care unit can also lead to frank outbreaks, harm, infection, and death. Next slide. This just shows you that in the United States, at least, if you go in the store and you buy certain products that are known to be susceptible to contamination, you will find this HACCP's certificate on the label, which shows you that that critical control point process has been followed. Next slide. Just a note about lean consumption. So, you know, we talked here about reliability being from the point of view of the patient. And I find this concept of lean consumption to actually be pretty useful. So in lean consumption, we're again creating a process map. But the idea here is that it provides patients exactly what they want and need, precisely when, where, and how they want it. We leave it to patients to figure out the system as it stands now. We train in the United States navigators, people we pay to help them figure out the system. And in systems we have, let's say if you have a lump in your breast, by the time you have that diagnosed, a CT scan, seeing a surgeon, have it taken out, and have your follow-up appointment, the huge amount of time and complexity in that system, and most of it's wasted and without value from the point of view of the patient. One way to deal with individual patient preferences and lean consumption is to do what's called mass customization. The core of the system is standard and uniform, but there are little variations at the very end of the system that allow you to customize it for an individual patient. So if you think about this from an industry standard, you may have a company that makes motorcycles. Let's say Kawasaki making motorcycles. And the basic motorcycle comes in a core model, a core framework with core elements. But at the last part of production, they can paint it red or green or blue or silver. They can add bigger brakes. They can put in special mirrors. They can have a large eagle on the front that whistles a command. And they can do whatever they want at the end of that. But the core process has its critical control points that are monitored carefully so that what's done at the end doesn't require the entire system to be changed every time. And that's a good principle to use for designing care pathways or clinical pathways. And so that leads me to ask whether all of you, when you're designing a bundle or a clinical pathway or even a clinical practice guideline, have a patient on your team, because the patients are going to be the only people to have this true lean consumption perspective. Hip and knee replacement surgery, which is growing by leaps and bounds in the United States, a good example of this. That's a complex system of care from the time a decision is made to put in a new joint to the time the patient's fully rehabbed and ready to resume life or close to normal life. And I can tell you, if you look at it from the point of view of the providers, they're not thinking like patients. I remember the powerful story of a woman whose mother had gone in for hip replacement at a famous institution. And they had had their group visit, which is a good thing, to orient the patients about the procedure. And when they got to the discussion, there were comments like, well, by the nurse, well, if your doctor's Dr. Jones, Dr. Jones likes to get you out of bed and send you home within 72 hours. If you have Dr. Smith, he'll do all your rehabbing and start your PT in the hospital. You'll be here for a week. And the patient, the mother, looked at her daughter and looked at each other and realized that they had no idea this variation in care and had no way that they were going to be able to provide the in-home support that was required by Dr. Jones to have a safe rehabilitation. So just an example to emphasize the importance of the patient perspective. Next slide. So let's talk a little bit about the standardization and making reliable care. The question I sometimes think about is, do these efforts to achieve reliable processes and care pathways stifle innovation? That'd be important. If in fact there's less innovation, that's a bad thing. Do they nurture a learning healthcare system? Do we learn from the variation that occurs when you decide not to follow the pathway? Do we learn from every single patient, so-called N of one trial, from their individual experience, so that we can build better pathways? Are we recording data in a registry or some sort of database that will give us clinical data that will allow us to look across large numbers of patients and determine what worked and what didn't? In other words, develop new evidence that's apart from the usual randomized controlled clinical trials. These are important questions to ask when you're trying to standardize care, care pathways, and bundles. Next slide. So I'm going to give you an example, and this is going to seem like a very esoteric example, but I want to point out the perils of trying to get really slick and fancy about this all from the right place, the right mindset. And this is what's called SCAMPS. It's a effort at Boston Children's Hospital to learn from care pathways, basically. Next slide. So here's the elements of SCAMPS. You see the acronym there. It assumes there's no such thing as best practice for most components of care, only sound practice that we're constantly learning from and changing. Very few decisions actually informed by absolutely conclusive evidence. Data collection should be targeted based on prior probabilities. So in other words, we ought to really think through when we're looking at outcomes and processes of care, what previous experiences taught us is more likely than to happen than not. And it allows the concept that you can deviate from the standard pathway, but you have to record the reasons so that we can learn from the deviations and accelerate improvement. The next slide goes into this a little more. So you have practitioners, providers agree to standard practice for some clinical scenarios and define what sound practice would be. You collect data about the decisions and results of using that pathway. You record deviations of care, which are encouraged, but must be recorded so you can learn. And then you redesign the standard care based on clinical judgment, prior knowledge, and an analysis of this new experience of real practitioners accepting or not accepting the guidance of the guideline. And this is just the ideal situation on the next slide, where you're constantly learning and refining your evidence base and making your standard pathway essentially customized to the practice and patients in an individual community. Next slide. So what are the challenges of this? I've actually watched this unfold firsthand, and I issue it as a real caution to those of you out there who want to get messianic about applying these kinds of principles to developing better bundles and care pathways. It's tons of work to create just one. And by the way, you have to constantly analyze it and revise it. It covers only a tiny fraction of all the systems and processes that need to be improved. You can't possibly work on the 47 conditions in infectious disease or in cardiology. Just exhausting. The system as it is almost everywhere is non-automated. I mean, this is all on paper. Imagine the challenge of getting people to do this on paper and how hard it is to learn from paper documentation. So I often say that until you can automate this stuff, it's probably more effort than is going to be tolerated by clinicians. And finally, even though you do all this, you may not resolve ambiguities in the evidence because you're not really doing structured clinical trials. You're trying to learn from experience, and we know that can be hazardous. Next slide. So here's more challenges in trying to create reliable care pathways, including or not including bundles, along with some opportunities. So first, even if all the steps are solidly evidence-based and executed reliably, remember the outcome may not improve dramatically. Those of you in infection control know this. You can implement all the stuff you read about in those guidelines, and boy, you just train people and you're monitoring and carrying on, and the outcome you're interested in, the pneumonia or whatever it is, doesn't improve as dramatically as you had assumed. And I think the reason for this is that even though we get quite reliable, it's rarely, or at least often, is not as high as it really needs to be to change outcomes. It may be to change a key outcome that you have to get levels of reliability at 1% defect, and that is almost never done in healthcare, as I already said. Secondly, what we know from the evidence and put into our bundles and pathways doesn't account for all the unmeasured effects on that outcome. And there are many examples of some medicine. So if you follow evidence-based surgical procedures, as in the United States we call this the SCIP procedures and measures, compliance with those doesn't correlate very well with actually dramatically improved outcomes, because there's all kinds of other stuff going on that we can't measure around surgical technique and teamwork in the operating room and so forth. So we underestimate the role of unmeasured variables, and we underestimate the level of reliability needed to move outcomes. So don't be discouraged. That's why we have both process and outcome measures, and why we have a learning healthcare system that's constantly learning from the failure systems to move outcomes. Second point is the pathway started as nursing tools, and in many institutions they remain nursing tools. Well, last I looked, doctors are the ones making diagnosis and making treatment decisions, not nurses. You can debate whether that's good, bad, or indifferent, but it's inherently a multidisciplinary, interprofessional activity. And it's just hard to get physicians, nurses, clinical pharmacists to communicate and make rounds together. And to have a care pathway only about the nursing is a fragment of what the pathways you need. So figuring out how to have a care pathway that reflects the decisions of all the professions in the care of that patient, and to get coordination around activating and complying with that pathway, is a challenge. Next slide. So more challenges. You have to clearly indicate to whom the pathway or the bundle does and does not apply. My own experiences is that the older and more complicated patients are, the more comorbidities they have, the more frail they are, the harder it is to have a care pathway. Because you can have a care pathway for diabetes and for hypertension and for obesity and for heart failure and for any one of the sometimes 6 or 10 comorbidities an old person may have. And those pathways are all separate. They don't really incorporate the reality of the entire patient. And sometimes they, frankly, conflict with each other. There was a very interesting study about 5 or 6 years ago that showed that in the average elder person in the United States, there were at least 2 comorbidities, and often 6 or 7. They were on as many as 14 different medications, not including over-the-counter medications, and that the guidelines and of these various comorbidities conflicted with each other, and the drugs sometimes interacted with each other. And so it was almost chaotic to put all that together for single patients. That's a real limitation of single condition pathways. As I mentioned, try and incorporate checklists at critical points in the pathway judiciously. Build in stop points, times where the pathway clearly says, check here to see if something can be discontinued. So what the heck is TGIDNTA? It's my little fun acronym. Thank God I don't need that anymore. So on rounds, every day in concert with the patient, ought to be looking, is this the day we check to see if we stop the antibiotics? Is this the day we check to take out the Foley catheter? Is this the day we take out the IV? Yes or no? And if the answer is yes, we do, you have a little celebration for the patient. Thank God you don't need that anymore. But that's got to be built into the routine of care. Use standardized order sets liberally to drive evidence-based prescribing. Standardized order sets are very powerful. They're used very commonly in surgery. I think they really do help standardized care, provided you allow for exceptions and require documentation so that you can learn from those exceptions. Institutions will put in the need for approval to deviate from the standard order set. That becomes extremely labor-intensive and tends to set up confrontation. I don't object to it, but I think that allowing deviation and then monitor the reason for the deviation is probably more efficient. Next slide. Some more challenges. As I mentioned, allow clinicians to opt out. Always allow clinicians to opt out of the pathway, the standardized order set, the bundle, based on their experience and judgment. That's how you get loyalty and buy-in. The guidelines, again, require documentation. At least in this country, if you do document why you deviated, it's almost impossible to be found liable in a lawsuit against a physician, or for that matter, a nurse. Why is that? Because almost every jury will understand that a physician has special deep training that was the whole point of which was to allow them to use individual clinical judgment for an individual patient. And it's understood that blind following of guidelines and standards and pathways and bundles can cause more harm than good in some patients. So again, it's a question of opting out and documenting in a reasonable way why you did so. Obviously, you want to draw on guidelines from professional societies and agencies. You'd be crazy not to look at the WHO guidance and incorporate in a local practice. And be especially realistic about what it takes to maintain a clinical pathway or any other evidence-based technique you have for improving reliability. It is a, as I call it, a slog to get people back into the room, to go over the latest evidence. And, of course, in the age we live in now, evidence is coming all the time. There's always a new study. I mean, I show up with our fellows or our residents, and they say, gee, Don, have you seen the study in some journal I never heard of that looks like the definitive study for some tiny component of the guideline? Got to get everybody back together and say, is the evidence good enough? Are we going to change the pathway? You have to change the forms, change the computer. It's really, really labor-intensive, always underestimated. Next slide. Always include quality metrics or measures in the clinical pathways or in bundles or checklists. That can be collected as part of routine work. That is so critical. If your plan is to have some nurse or volunteer or student collect the data separately from routine work, right away you're in trouble. The discipline of making the data collection part of the routine work and having the data be visible to everybody drives the creation of more efficient, more realistic systems. It's a great challenge. If you can't figure out a way to get what you need in the form of a checklist or a data point in the routine work, you're probably creating more work than necessary and creating waste. And then always, as I mentioned before, think about balancing measures, the unintended consequences. So in the United States, we had antibody treatment for pneumonia within 4 hours or 6 hours, I'm forgetting now, of arrival in the emergency department as a core measure on which you would be evaluated and compensated. So it was a pay-for-performance measure. And what happened was that anytime a patient hit the emergency department who had anything in the chest that could conceivably be pneumonia, heart failure, atelectasis, whatever, they got a dose of antibiotic because, by golly, you're going to get credit no matter what. And it's been well documented that was an unintended, pernicious consequence of the pay-for-performance measure. And worse than that, of course, once starting an antibiotic, you need a system to stop it, as I pointed out earlier. And so patients are getting C. diff and other unintended consequences, let alone antibiotic resistance, due to a well-intended quality improvement initiative. Next slide. So here's a useful analogy. I don't know how many of you are from which country, I can't see all that. But when I was growing up, we had what we call a triptych. Next slide. Here's a triptych. My dad and my mom, I'm an only child, took me around the United States in their old car on a, I think it was a five-week trip. I mean, we went through Ohio and Chicago and into North Dakota and down through California and into American Indian country and swung back through the South. And great trip. I remember it so well. We used a triptych provided by the American Automobile Association that had our entire route planned out. On the next slide, you see what these look like. And this one isn't highlighted, but the AAA agent would use a highlighter, and this is not done on a computer, to highlight the route you're going to take. And as you can see, it's annotated. All along the route, there are little notes about what you might want to visit, where you might want to stay, how long it takes to get there. And this triptych now you can get online, but the basic concept is the same. And we guided ourselves through America using this, I'll call it a care pathway. This was a care pathway for Sydney and Beatrice and Donald to go around the United States getting all the help they needed along the way. Next slide. Now, of course, we have global positioning systems or GPS. I have one I put in my car. I now can do it on my cell phone. It's great. It shows the road where I'm going. It may tell me the traffic. but it isn't nearly as rich as that triptych. It's a very stripped down pathway that isn't really a care pathway. It's an orientation positioning system, and it's only useful for a limited spectrum of activity. Next slide. So what would be better, and what would make them both better, if you're in a internet web-based system? Real-time hot link. So not only does the triptych say, by the way, you might want to stop at this world-class Memphis-style barbecue there in Tennessee, but you just click on this thing here, and you'll see the menu and the hours of operation and exactly where it is. Real-time feedback. So what you'd really like is there's an enormous pothole in the road, and your GPS system starts blinking at you saying, you know, you better watch out for that pothole. Some of it happens already, especially around traffic. And then wouldn't it be great if you had a learning triptych, like a learning healthcare system, where some driver deviated from the triptych? My dad said, you know, I just heard that there's this country road that takes us through some interesting places where they used to have mining towns that are now empty when the mining boom ended. Let's go there. Well, it would be great if in real time that my father could feed into the triptych so that others would be aware of this alternative. And in the internet age, we, of course, are getting better and better at that. And you can now go online. You'll see people popping up with all kinds of alternatives and deviations from the pathway. So I'm just showing you all this as a kind of interplay between what you do when you drive and get decision support along the way. And yes, there's a standardized best route, but there are other ways and other learnings that can happen as well. Next slide. Of course, global information systems with real-time monitoring of the environment in which you're working are going to be really important. Interestingly enough, this is a map of Soho and the great cholera epidemic in London in the 19th century. And you can imagine if this were on a global information system, how cool that would be. As new cases pop up, a new light appears, and Jon Snow goes over to his map and starts thinking about, that's interesting. Well, look at that water pump there. They all seem to be going there. And, of course, we're using this all the time. This shows land use change on the next slide. Monitored in real time, you can do this with temperature sensors to show how the urban sprawl is affecting the entire world and where there are heat islands in the entire world. So we're in a different era, and we just need to be very agile about adapting this to healthcare. So the next slide shows a few tips about innovating at the front line, because I was worried, you'll remember, about standardization and reliability stifling innovation. So here's some tips. First, harvest intrinsic motivation. Everybody at the front line wants to be an innovator. Believe me, they want better ways of care. We beat it out of them when we just talk only about standardization, reliability, bundles. As hard as it is, carve out even a little bit of protected time for them to think through their ideas, preferably with some colleagues. Now, I say here provides financial support. I do this a little bit tongue-in-cheek, because even at IHI, which relies on the innovation we do, we spend less than 1% of our budget, maybe 2% on innovation. The most innovative industries are spending more than 5% of their revenue on innovation, because it's a central pipeline for them. And I would argue that even in the most resource-constrained environments, think carefully about how much of that resource, even if it's a small fraction, is actually enabling innovation. Just making that calculation, and you may conclude, we can't innovate at all. We're lucky to get the 600 patients who are lined up out there with their families through this door to make sure they don't have malaria or check on their anemia. That's fine, but being explicit is really important for the front line. And some of the larger organizations, of course, have a dedicated research and development or innovation team that has assistants and can do qualitative research and behavioral science and economics and system engineering. That's all great if you're in a position to draw on interprofessional expertise to help innovation. That's great, but I know it's unrealistic for many people. Next slide. More important is to tolerate risk. And you got to have a culture in which people aren't afraid to fail. People ought to be encouraged to fail frequently, but fail quickly and fail well. Never fail without learning about that failure. You can't innovate unless you're willing to fail. You can't innovate unless you're willing to have the trust to let people fail and to actually celebrate the culture that allowed them to fail publicly. Have a not invented here mentality, especially in those of you in academic medical centers or in large centers of excellence. We always think that, you know, what we have is the best, and if we didn't invent it, it probably isn't good enough for us. And the really innovative companies like Procter & Gamble will actually have a measure for the percentage of products that were not invented at Procter & Gamble. They regard it as a success as that percentage of not invented here products goes up. So that's a culture change as well. Next slide. Part of this is noticing, testing, and adopting and rewarding disruptive innovation. So I don't have time today to go into the entire mantra on disruptive innovation. I would refer you to books by a really brilliant business person, Clayton Christensen, who has taken a great interest in healthcare. He has a book called The Innovator's Prescription, which goes into this in great detail. But it's basically in looking for those wild and crazy ideas that really disrupt the system, that aren't the way we've always been doing it, but are entirely different, probably at the beginning pretty crude and in need of a lot of refinement. But that's kind of important to understand that there are those kind of ideas out there and you need to harvest them. I still remember a time that a Greek delegation came to Boston Children's Hospital at the behest of our Chamber of Commerce, the department that tries to get people in other countries to buy U.S. technology. And they came back with this delegation in suits, and what they wanted was to purchase a solid organ transplant program, basically, and some intensive care program and the equipment that went with it. And along with them was this wiry, kind of bent over, disheveled guy with his tie hanging down and his hair was all a mess. And he come over to me and he says, "Dr. Goldman, Dr. Goldman." And he drags me off to the side. I don't want anybody to hear this, but he's tugging on my sleeve. He said, "Don't let them buy this stuff. We don't have the systems to support it. We're going to buy this expensive stuff and we're going to hurt patients. They're going to get infections. They're going to die because of this." And he had some ideas that would be obviously disruptive in his culture, but he was essentially saying, let's not go that path. Let's go a different path where we get simple stuff to be reliable and right. That was, for his culture, actually really innovative, and it shouldn't have been in secret tugging on my sleeve. Promoting and celebrating positive deviance is really important. So positive deviance, what is that? It's a term that was actually coined and invented in work in Africa on two problems. One was malnutrition. The other was female circumcision. And in both cases, there was a important qualitative kind of ethnographic, anthropologic almost, look at where there were individuals or communities that were not practicing female circumcision despite their prevailing culture, or were providing nutrition despite the scarcity and the fatalism all around them. And once you recognize those positive deviants who succeeded despite all the cultural norms and circumstances, you can begin to understand how they did it, and then you can begin to spread it. So I'm told that another example of this actually is the virtual eradication of foot binding of women in China, which again was this idea, who's managing to do this? It wasn't it didn't start with some national edict. It started with positive deviants and gradual spreading of their success despite all odds. So definitely respect those quirky folks with strange ideas. They may be disruptors or positive deviants. Next slide. Well, I'm going to actually stop there. I see that we're just about out of time. I was going to show you pictures of about 12 or so churches and teach you how to learn from observing ecclesiastical architecture, but I actually thought when I was putting together this talk that was a bit much, a bit off point. But I would urge you to do this. You all have the slides. Look at the evolution from the original Carolingian simple churches with their solid practical structure all the way through the apotheosis of high Gothic style at the Cathedral of Amiens, which was the pinnacle, the absolute limit of what Gothic architecture and the apprentice system of learning by trial and error could conceivably do. the churches after that were made on computer models. And I'm not going to tell you the answer to this, but I want you to look at the difference between the design and especially the ornamentation and the craftsmanship of those churches and the beauty, but the difference in ornamentation and craftsmanship in the computer-generated churches. And think about what you lose when you go from trial and error and the apprentice system and detail and that kind of church building, when you move from that to stuff that you're doing on a computer based on tensile strengths and the elasticity of materials. I'm not going to give you my opinion on that, but just if you would reflect. So that's all I have to say today, and I see that we're just about at the hour mark.
Thank you very much, Don, for this really insightful and original presentation, including your artistic conclusion. So on behalf of the audience, I just would like to ask you a quick question.
Yes.
Even if we are almost at the hour, but I guess that Paul told us that we can take some few more minutes. So I was really interested in the SCAMS approach, and I would like to ask you whether you would have for us a practical example of implementation of the SCAMS approach in the infection control field.
Yeah, so I don't think that they've developed a SCAMP in the infection control field, but if I were to develop one, I would pick the example of complications of ventilation. So, you know, we have a bundle, the ventilator bundle, which was misnamed, actually, by others, the ventilator pneumonia bundle. It wasn't really a bundle at all. It's a series of processes that are designed to reduce complications of ventilation, including deep venous thrombosis and GI bleeding and so forth, as well as the trauma of ventilation and, by the way, pneumonia. In fact, if you look at it, you'll find that two of the elements, use of peptic acid inhibitors and actually increases the risk of pneumonia. I can't remember it right now, but it didn't make any sense at all from pneumonia. So if I were to develop a SCAMP, and let's just call it a care pathway, because I'm not advocating for SCAMPs. I think it's way too complicated to put into practice almost anywhere. But if I were to develop a care pathway, it would be from the moment an individual is ventilated, what are the key elements of the care of that patient that will get them off of the ventilator as early as possible in the best condition without any complications. And there are some critical control points there. There's the way in which you use sedation. There are actually intensive care units in Denmark which are using incredibly little sedation. They just believe that people can be conscious with the right kind of medication that doesn't put them out. They get them up in a chair almost immediately, even elderly patients. They allow a lot of interaction with the family. They do tests at very standard intervals as to whether they're getting ready to be weaned from the thing. So that all lends itself to care pathway. And you could imagine it as being primarily nursing, but imagine how more powerful if it's a nurse physician, a respiratory therapist pathway that gets you to that, thank God I don't need that anymore, moment for the ventilator 5 days sooner and a whole lot safer than if you didn't have a pathway like that.
Thank you very much, really, for even giving us the perspective of something which requires more research, and I think that also for our audience, this is very interesting to be put in perspective. So really, thank you very much for this addition. I would like to remind the audience about the next WHO teleclass on October 2nd, where Professor Shaheen Mehtar will make a presentation on the role of education in low and middle income countries. And again, I would like to thank the Weber Training System for hosting us today. Professor Goldman, again, for his knowledge and availability to share ideas and such an insightful presentation. We really hope to have you again next year. And I wish you a good day and keep in touch for next teleclass, as I said. Goodbye, everyone. Goodbye, Dawn. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.